LibroFM lets you purchase audiobooks directly from your favorite local bookstore. Choose from more than 150,000 audiobooks, including New York Times bestsellers and recommendations from booksellers around the country. With LibroFM, you'll get the same audiobooks at the same price as the largest audiobook company out there. You know what one we're talking about, but you'll be part of a much different story, one that supports community.
If you're new to audiobooks, they're the perfect way to get more books into your busy life. Listen while doing chores, walking the dog, or just relaxing at home. All you need is a smartphone and the free LibroFM app.
If you already love audiobooks and don't know what to listen to next, check out recommendations and curated lists from the people who know audiobooks best, local booksellers.
Listeners of the Bookstore Podcast can get a 2-month audiobook membership for the price of 1 month.
Go to Libro.fm, that's LIBRO.FM, and enter bookstore at checkout. With each listen, take pride in knowing that you're supporting local bookstores.
Welcome to the Bookstore.
It's like a book club, but we actually read the book.
I'm Becca.
And I am Corinne. This week, I think we've kind of been ramping up that the book we've read is really a complete 180 from what we have read recently, specifically Model Land. Just be aware that this is not going to match the tone of a goofy episode. And also, just in general, the world feels incredibly unstable right now. So this may be an emotional one. I think we'll start by going into the summary.
We read Memorial Drive by Natasha Trethewey. This was published in July of this year by Echo. Trethewey was the United States Poet Laureate in 2012 and 2013, and she won the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry in 2007 for her book Native Guard. This is her first all prose work. This memoir is Trethewey's story about her mother's murder by her stepfather. Like you already said, it's very upsetting. We're going to talk about it, so use caution if you're listening to this episode if you haven't read the book. Trethewey's parents divorce when she's young, and her mother, Gwendolyn, dates and eventually remarries Joel, with whom she has a son, Joey. Joel very quickly becomes controlling and abusive to Trethewey and her mother, although Trethewey does not tell her mother about the abuse. Her mother does eventually leave Joel and ask for a divorce, and Trethewey includes transcripts of phone conversations between her mother and Joel in the days before her mother's death. So this is, I mean, it's a lot like other grief memoirs in that it's Trethewey remembering her mother and the steps leading up to her murder, and she also kind of includes some maybe more like not present day, but years, like 20 years after her mother's death as well. But it's also, I want to say, very different from other memoirs that I've read about grief.
As you said, this one, like, it truly does, like, hit differently. I'm sure we've probably talked about this on the podcast before, but both you and I have lost a parent, and holy shit, I'm already like ready to cry. this book like made me, I don't know, it touched something like raw, I guess, that I didn't realize was necessarily still there. I've read plenty of other books about grief and like dealing with the loss of a parent. Lots of books are about that subject because it's, you know, it's one of the things that, you know, practically everyone has to deal with at some point in their life. I don't know. Like you said, this one just to me felt different than a lot of those types of books that I've read before. Even though the circumstances are like couldn't be further, you know, from the circumstances of my dad's death. It just... Yeah, she still manages to hit something loss.
Yes.
Just in general.
Yeah, I think too, this one reminded me in a lot of ways of Chanel Miller's Know My Name, in that I don't think...
I thought the same thing.
I don't think I ever... Those two books, I guess I would say, really made me feel how difficult it is to write a memoir about this. And obviously, like, I would know, I don't want to write about my mom's death at all. But right. I think in a lot of ways, I tend to think people who write grief memoirs do it and it's a relief or it's therapeutic for them. And these two books made me kind of see how, just realize how absolutely like difficult it is to write something like that and really like look back into your past and into the exact thing that you don't want to think about, but you can't help thinking about and write about it.
Yeah, it's an interesting book too. I mean, you wrote one of the questions here. I'm just going to ask it, but I'll give you credit for writing it because I didn't do any of these. But you, so you said, like, as you said here, Trethewey is an accomplished poet. And I think like the way that the book is structured maybe gives that away a little bit. I think I knew that, but I didn't have it like top of mind going in reading this. So I think I was pretty much just reminded. But now that makes sense to me, having finished this fairly recently. So how do you think that kind of shapes maybe the way that she wrote the book?
Yeah, I think for me, the way she writes her prose, it's so beautiful, but it doesn't ever give way to the, I don't know what I want to say, like more metaphorical than I can kind of handle as somebody who doesn't read poetry.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I think poets writing prose can go too far in the other direction. And she didn't. Like, I think she was able to really ground what she was writing. And even when she, you know, she writes about like a dream sequence she has about her mother, and it still felt authentic, I guess, and real to me.
Yeah. At first, it was a little bit off-putting for me because she talks a lot kind of like about the process of like crafting metaphor and then mm-hmm. applying that to her life. And I don't say off-putting like in a bad way necessarily, but now like looking back on it, it makes a lot of sense that she would be analyzing all of that a lot. And that like, because her life is writing poetry, it is something that she would apply to her life and like her experiences. So looking at that now, it makes a lot of sense. And also it's really kind of an interesting way to like look back on your life and do it from this sort of like literary academic sort of sense mm-hmm. of like applying those devices to your experiences. But she does it in a way that's like analytical and not just like, you know, turning everything into a memoir and expecting you to think it's the most breathtaking thing you've ever, you know, seen
right.
or whatever. She kind of like walks you through that, which was really interesting to me.
Yeah, I think being able to see the process of how she crafted it really is maybe the thing that makes this stand out for me as opposed to other people's grief memoirs.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess maybe if we just talk a little bit generally about like the way that the novel is constructed, the beginning, I mean, it's pretty typical, I think, for like memoirs, where the beginning she kind of covers her early life when her mother and her biological father were still together, and their life in Mississippi, and up until their divorce when she moves to Atlanta with her mother. So that was all like really pretty typical. I think maybe I felt a little bit detached from those first couple chapters, and then it became much more absorbing, I think, to me, when you finally kind of got a sense of where she was going and like what, I guess it sounds, oh God, it's hard to talk about because I don't want to sound blasé or sound like her life is a plot because it's her life and it's not, you know, some sort yeah. of like narrative device necessarily. But yeah, I think it became a little bit more engrossing when she got to talking about sort of the things that would end up being incredibly consequential to her mother's eventual death. And so part of that is that like once her mom starts seeing Joel, you can see really slowly the way that his abuse towards both Natasha and her mother kind of like starts to ramp up. And that's very kind of compelling. God, again, that sounds crass, but you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. I think the beginning of the book really feels like it was a nice read. Like, this is a nice memoir about a, you know, Natasha, her dad is white, her mom is black. So it just, again, not nice, but like a solid, basic, good, enjoyable memoir to read that's interesting. But then you kind of find out that something's weird about it. I mean, obviously, you know, before going into it about Joel, and then it really starts to change because it still kind of maintained that kind of almost like the same tone, except now you know something bad is going to happen.
Yeah.
And you don't know when it's going to happen. And it's very upsetting because the way it's written, you almost can't help but feel, at least for me, I felt a weird kind of hope for Natasha's mother or Trethewey's mother to get away. And then, but knowing that she's not going to get away, I was very difficult.
No, I agree with you. I think you can't help but, like, I guess, be kind of devastated, like, with the way things are going and knowing that that's what's going to happen. I think, you know, like, with memoirs, and we've talked about this before, it's always difficult to talk about them because why would I, like, enjoy reading about someone's suffering, you know? Mm-hmm. like there's a sense of, like, that being used as entertainment, and I don't think it was, obviously, in this case. I think it's at least a practice in empathy a little bit, and then also, like, seeing all of that laid out, especially in the part with the transcripts, is just really, really eye-opening. I think in a lot of ways it could be a tremendous learning experience for people who maybe don't understand what abusive relationships look like or how women can end up in them. Trethewey's mother had a master's degree in social work. She wasn't the way that people tend to think of, like, victims end up becoming victims of abuse. So it's really kind of shocking, I think, to read, but also very important for people to be able to understand.
Yeah, bear with me. I think I have a point to make, but, like, I think about true crime and how a lot of people interested in true crime, I think part of the interest is figuring out why the serial killer or the murderer did why they did what they did. There's no really way to figure it out. And then I know there's, like, obviously a big controversy over spending too much time on the killer versus the victim and things like that. And reading this, and so I kind of feel that way about men who are abusive, mm-hmm. and men who kill their partners, because it's such, I just don't understand it. It makes no sense to me. Reading the phone transcripts, because Trethewey's mom, Gwendolyn, when she leaves Joel, she records all of her phone conversations. Like, the police install a phone tap for her so that they can gather evidence against him, because she knows he's going to kill her, or he wants to kill her.
And he had been previously put in jail because he had assaulted her and pretty much was attempting murder on her when the police showed up at her apartment another time. So he has already gone to jail for this, and I think they just need further evidence in order to protect her and the children and get him out of their lives.
Yeah.
So that's what the precursor to the phone taping is.
And reading those phone transcripts, it's like, oh, I mean, I guess I always knew this, but he doesn't care about other people at all.
No.
Like, not at all. And it was, I honestly had to stop reading the phone transcripts because I felt, I actually had to put the phone down and go into the bathroom because I thought I was going to throw up, because it's so difficult to read somebody basically saying, your life doesn't matter and the kids' lives don't matter.
I mean, he says over and over again, like, it's one of the just kind of most deranged things I've ever read, because he's telling her that she has no choice, but he keeps believing that he has a choice. And the choices he gives her are, I'm going to kill you and myself, or you're going to learn to love me. And he says it, like, flat out,
yeah,
over and over and over again. And you're like, how can you not realize that those are not choices to give a person? It was chilling. It was terrifying. I don't know. Like, I've read other books about domestic violence. One that I wanted to bring up in the show is called No Visible Bruises, What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. It's by Rachel Louise Snyder. It's a really good kind of, like, journalistic look at what domestic abuse is, what it looks like, and, you know, like, the things that our country and our law enforcement do wrong to not, like, help victims, and then what we can do better. I think it's a great book, but it still didn't give me necessarily a sense of, like, what it must be like to be in one of these situations. And this phone transcript in the book is just, I don't know, it's devastating. It's shockingly deranged. Like I said before, I couldn't believe it. And the way that her mom appears to be responding to it, where she's just kind of calm and trying to reason with him. I don't know how she did that. Oh my God. Yeah, it was overwhelming.
Yeah, it was. And, you know, he goes on to say, like, she asks him, well, if you kill me, like, what, the kids, like, because Joey is his son, and obviously Trethway, Natasha, she's not, but the Gwendolyn's like, well, what, you know, what are the kids going to feel like? And his answer is just like, they'll get over it the same way you'll get over it when your mother eventually dies. And I just, like, I don't even know how to process somebody thinking like that. And I know I'm making this about me and I don't mean to, but like, my mom died. She died of cancer. We knew about it. It wasn't even like a sudden death, obviously very much not a violent death. And that was mm-hmm. painful enough and traumatic enough. So the reading somebody say, they'll just get over it.
Yeah.
And you're talking about the most violent death that you can give somebody. And then, I mean, yeah. I read that and I was like, never mind. I don't want to know. I don't care about what any murderer thinks ever. Like, I just don't care.
Well, I think that's the thing. And yeah, I mean, it's never going to make sense. I mean, like, it's not rational. So, like, why are you trying to apply reason to something like this? Like, this, and it is so much about possession for him. And I think, you know, that's also terrifying to see somebody basically saying, like, well, you took my life away, so by deciding to divorce me, and so I will take your life away because you did this to me. He keeps talking about how I'm going to take you with me, because his whole thing is he's going to attempt suicide so that they can be together forever in the afterlife or whatever. But of course, when it comes down to it, he doesn't do that either, because that was never the point.
Right.
It was literally just about controlling her. And that's so scary, too.
And there's no reasoning with that. How do you talk to somebody like that who fully believes that somebody breaking up with them is equivalent to killing that person? I don't understand. I've had bad breakups, but like, I just don't understand. And then Gwendolyn even brings it up. She's like, everybody, this happens. People separate. Nobody stays together forever. But to him, it's somehow different. And it's just, I don't want to bring up, it's got to be narcissism though, right? How do you feel like the world revolves around you and that nobody else has any feelings at all?
Yeah, and it's crazy to watch him, like, also take everything that he's done and then blame it on her. We do a lot of talking in like, popular culture now about gaslighting and stuff, but seeing it happen there, and, like, this is after they've known each other and they'd been married for, like, 10 years before. I think they're divorced at this point, but, you know, so this is something that happened over a decade, and he had beaten her before. I think that's the other thing. You know, one thing I think this book maybe doesn't quite, well, you know what? It does, actually. I was going to say, maybe it doesn't necessarily kind of explore the ways that, like, these things happen slowly over time until you get to this point where you can't leave. But I think it does, because he also is abusive toward Natasha mm-hmm. when she's a child. And it all starts as just kind of, like, emotional and kind of basically making her feel worthless all of the time. And she says at one point that she just doesn't tell her mom, which I thought was heartbreaking. And it also kind of speaks to the way that I think women see their roles, and women and girls specifically see their roles. She says at one point, I cannot understand why I did not confide in her, and I can't help asking myself whether her death was the price of my inexplicable silence. I remember believing that I was a good child, that I was good because I did not complain, that I could suffer through my own trials and protect my mother from the difficult knowledge of how her life with a new husband was affecting me. And yeah, I think that also goes to sort of explain why and how women end up in these situations, because in the early stages, you try to tell yourself, like, oh, it's not a big deal, and I'm just blowing this out of proportion or whatever. People are going to think I'm mean, or he's going to, you know, think that I'm nagging or whatever if I talk about this. But those early stages and those early red flags are, like, they're really important. And I don't, like, that sounds maybe a little victim blaming, but I think what I'm trying to get at is that, like, the way that women are socialized, and girls are socialized to kind of be not heard in these situations can really make it worse in the long run. And make these sort of situations possible, I think, is the thing. And that's not their fault. It just, it allows men to have that power.
It is. And
or that's how men can rely on that power.
Yes. And I think this book also shows, and it doesn't go into too much detail, but I think it also shows how it's like, where do you go? What do you do? Trethewey's mother had a, she was the one who made all the money. So she's not even in the position where a lot of women are, who are stuck in abusive relationships, in that they're stay-at-home moms. They haven't had a job in 20 years. They can't, they don't have any financial means. She actually does have financial means. And to me, that just sort of speaks to where Natasha's mother like had the money to get out and had the means, but she still couldn't. Mm-hmm. And it sort of shows how our society, we don't really have any help for women like this, or we have a little bit, but it's not enough when you're talking about a man who is determined to kill you.
Yeah. And I mean, like, it's all like, it's really huge and it's complicated too, right? Like, we can't just put people in jail for things that they didn't right. do. But it's also terrifying that, like, they only go to jail once they kill you, yes. right? So, yeah, it does kind of lay bare that whole conundrum. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's really scary.
Well, and, yeah. you know, in her situation too, there was supposed to be a cop outside her house and the cop left.
Yes.
And, you know, what was it? Was it a human mistake? Like, I understand we all make mistakes, but that's a mistake that led to somebody dying. And what happened to the cop? You know, she doesn't mm-hmm. talk about it, so I don't know. But I can't help but, like, wonder, you know, what happens when you leave the scene that you're supposed to be protecting somebody and you just don't. But about Natasha not telling her mother about the abuse, I think that's something that I feel like I see a lot on the internet with, like, advice stuff. Like, just talk to them, just tell them. And I don't think people really maybe understand the fear. Even if Natasha didn't know that she needed to be afraid of Joel, which I think she did, on some level I think she would have. Because you don't, if somebody's, like, super controlling and being abusive towards you, you don't just think, like, well, I'm just going to tell my mother and then she's going to talk to him and then it's going to stop. Like, that's not what would happen.
Right. And I think she eventually, like, her mother does kind of know that she's aware. So I think, you know, there's the point where Natasha first hears Joel hit her mother, and the next day at school she can't concentrate, and her teacher is, she's kind of like the teacher's pet, and her teacher follows her out of the classroom and is like, what's going on? What is wrong? Because it's very unlike her. And she says, I heard my stepfather hit my mother last night. And the teacher is basically just like, well, adults have fights sometimes. And then later something happens where she overhears them, and she hears her mother say, like, Natasha knows that this is happening, right? And then it gets worse. Yeah. So, like, I think there's also probably an internalized fear that, like, I could cause my mother to get hurt more. We just need to get through this somehow. I don't know. It's just, yeah, it's really complicated. And you can't know the way that, like, an abuser is going to react to anything. And especially if they're already violent towards you. What do you do?
The teacher saying that also just made me think of how normalized abuse is. And I know everybody will say, like, no, real men don't hit women, but it obviously happens way more than what anybody thinks happens.
This was also the late 70s too.
Right, of course, yeah. And so definitely back then, it wasn't the way it is now. But I mean, even now, you know.
Yes.
There's still, like, jokes made about domestic violence and things like that, and it's, like, all just supposed to be jokes. But, like, where do those jokes come from? Is they come from a time not that long ago to where teachers would just be like, oh, well, parents are you horrifying. Do you want to talk about when Trethewey goes to see a medium?
Yeah, so at some point, I mean, this is years and years, I think I don't know, maybe close to 20 years after her mother's death. She goes to see a medium. She is skeptical, so she just kind of gives the person as little feedback as she possibly can. Because I think the guy is very much like a John Edwards type. I don't know if anybody remembers that television show where he does like those cold readings where he'll just be like, the letter J is speaking to me. And then, you know, somebody feeds like, oh, my grandpa's name was John or whatever. And then, you know, he can kind of like forge everything from there. And yeah, she gives as little information as possible. And she basically leaves disappointed because while he claims to, you know, be speaking to her grandmother and her father, who has at the time also passed away, she doesn't hear anything from her mother, who she's obviously seeking more than anything.
I thought that was really interesting because at first I was like, oh no, what are we doing here?
Yeah.
But I would have done the same thing. I mean, I would have done the same thing and like not given anybody anything. So I did like that she did that with the medium. And I thought it was interesting because in the end, she kind of, because the medium comes up with like the month of May. And then afterwards, she's thinking about it and she's like, well, if you write the date that my mother died, because Americans write it month, day, year, but Europeans write it day, month, year, that, yes. And he was British, that he would have thought, what was it, 5-6, whatever the year was, instead of being May 6, it would have been June 6, or how was it?
May 5th.
May 5th.
Wait.
No. Mother died.
May 6th, it would have been June 5th.
Yeah. So her mother died on June 5th, right?
Yes.
But then, but if you were reading it the other way, it would have been May 6th. So,
yes.
Then she's like, oh, maybe my mother was trying to come through because he, you know, because he was thinking of May and whatever. And I thought that was interesting because I really thought it was like such a, it's the way people, when they're grieving, kind of have that leap of logic. And she writes about that too, how am I just fishing for something so I can believe in this?
I mean, I am maybe like the most skeptical of all people, and I am not at all spiritual or religiously inclined. So like I feel that too, but like sometimes, you know, like when you're talking about loss, like that would be a comfort.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought that too. I thought, you know, because I understand, again, I'm the same as you, but, and I understand wanting there to be something. So I thought that was like an interesting way of writing. And if I am going to have to read about somebody going to a medium, like that would be how I would want to read it. Somebody being like very honest about how they don't really believe in this stuff, but then they also really want to believe in it. And what does it mean that they don't believe, but they want to believe? I don't know. Yeah, that was very confusing.
No, I think, but it's, I don't know, it's such an understandable position to take. And I think what I really appreciated about it was like the transparency of it, like her knowing what she was seeking and also recognizing that it didn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
And that it didn't quite fit with like her beliefs and that sort of thing, but still like having that desire no matter what, like, and regardless of that, and then allowing herself that hope, but then still being devastated by it, like realizing that maybe it was just nothing, you know. I think it's such a roller coaster that like that grief does just kind of send you on sometimes.
Yeah.
I'm afraid if I talk about most of this out loud, I'm just going to start crying. And then I can't talk and cry at the same time. So it's not going to make for a good podcast. The parts that really, really struck me are when she's kind of talking about this, like these vast kind of swaths of her life that were taken from her because during them, she was traumatized by Joel. And I think she tries to forget about those times that she had, but then she recognizes too that that's 10 years of her young life that got taken from her. And then also her entire future with her mother that got taken too. And kind of also, it's not necessarily just the grief of losing her mother, but this grief over not being able to access those memories and whatever she did have with her mom, because mm-hmm. she kind of tried to let go of it at the time as a way to not have to feel that pain and stuff too. And I think it's just, it's a part of the whole process that I don't necessarily think gets spoken about in a really articulate kind of manner, in a way that like really made, I don't know, like as tangible as it is here. And I just found that just so heart-wrenching. Truly, I think that's where she really kind of like goes above and beyond some other grief memoirs.
Yeah, I agree. The part about her remembering her mother's record collection, but that she had thrown it out in the moment because it was just too painful to even consider, but now she wishes she has it, like she wishes she still had it. That was so difficult to read, because I don't know, it just makes me think of like a lot of grief books and stuff tell you to get rid of a lot of stuff so that you don't have it hanging mm-hmm. around and you're not wallowing in your grief. But then there's the fact of like, well, what if you do want it later, and what if it does mean something? And I guess to me too, just her mother's records that she had collected for so long. I mean, I know this sounds like materialistic probably, but just being able to like listen to your mother's or any really loved one's like entire music collection would be so important and so amazing to do, because you would be able to like chart their life and what they liked throughout their life, and then to not have it anymore. That was like, yeah, absolutely heartbreaking to read.
There's this chapter, Disclosure, where she talks about like what we were just saying about how she lost those things. And then at the end of it, she finds a tape that has her mother's voice on it. This part really upset me. Shit. I think about 3 months after my dad died, I was going through my phone. I don't know how I wound up in this like file folder thing. It was like some stupid like off-brand Motorola razor. Remember Motorola razors? Remember when phones weren't all like this? And so I was going through it. I wound up in this weird file, and it had strange like random audio clips from voicemails that had been left on my phone.
Oh no. Oh no, I'm gonna cry. Yeah. I know what's coming. I know.
And a handful of them were my dad's voice. And I don't have those anymore, because when I switched my phone, I didn't think about transferring those files or anything. And this part is just like, it's the most, I don't know, I had to put the book down and like walk away. So she finds this audio tape. She says, after I'd pressed play, my mother came back to me for less than 30 seconds before the tape snagged in the machine. Her voice garbled and stopped. I took the cassette out and wound the tape gently, flattening the length of it as I went. But each time I put it back into play, it would catch before I could hear her utter another word. I kept taking it out, smoothing it over and over, stretching it between my fingers until the worn tape snapped in my hands. Had I waited, I might have been able to save it. The length of tape that had been her voice had been as tenuous as the faith that held Orpheus and Eurydice together as he tried to lead her out of the underworld. In my impatience, I had severed it. Obviously, I'm destroyed. So this, this book gets it. Anyway, I'll cut out most of it.
Take lots of pictures of your parents, guys. I don't know how to come back from that.
Right?
Oh, man. This, this was a lot to read this book.
Can we come back from that in any meaningful way? I think the interesting thing that she does here is, like, she doesn't try to draw like any grand conclusion, which I think is like, it's really tempting to do when you're talking about loss or anything at all, right? Because like, that's what we're told is a narrative. Like, at some point you've got to like draw it to some sort of, you know, neat conclusion, and it doesn't do that, which I appreciate.
Yes, I think that's also what really sets it apart from other grief memoirs. Is in a lot of them, there's kind of this thread of like, you know, this is what happened, this is how bad I felt, but this is what I'm going to do with my like future. Mm-hmm. And I think in a lot of ways, Trethewey is kind of saying like, I'm not just going to look at my future, I am going to look at the past too, yeah, I think that's not really necessarily the theme of what a lot of grief memoirs talk about, is how, you know, it is important to look at the past. And I did think, too, the fact that the book starts with the dream and then ends with the dream really was just a lovely way of doing it, too. She talks about it, like, she mentions, like, this is what I'm going to do. But I still thought it was, I don't know, it was really good. And I'm not really one for hearing about people's dreams. But I did think hers, again, she just has that really... her writing style just has a really good balance between being really beautiful and poetic, but also staying completely grounded in this world and not making it too, like, woo-woo for me personally.
Right. And I think, again, because she is, like, sort of constantly analyzing these metaphors that she uses and specifically calls them out as metaphors, like, it does have, I guess I've said transparency a number of times, but it has this sort of, like, process feeling to it where you're, like, she's aware of what she's doing and she doesn't want it to be, like, too heavy-handed and, you know, but, like, this is her impulse as a poet and here is why she's doing it. And I think that's a really, like, interesting perspective to get on a story like this.
Yeah. And it did make me feel not like a voyeur.
Sure. Yeah.
Because sometimes I think memoirs do have that way of feeling like they're letting you in, but they also want you to know that this, like, you shouldn't be wanting to read this, I guess, kind of thing. Whereas Trethewey does feel, she just feels very, very intentional about everything that she writes. And I liked that.
It's not too, like, invasive. It's, you're right. I think she manages to keep the balance, like, exactly where it needs to be. And I think that's really a huge accomplishment, considering she manages to pull off, like, all of the emotional weight that it does have. Well, I mean, this book is just barely over 200 pages long, I think, which I know I bring up page lengths a lot, but this is a lot to put in while making it seem like actually quite effortless at the same time. I don't know. It was definitely an experience. I really wasn't looking forward to reading this book. I can't say it was, like, pleasurable, obviously.
Right.
I just spent, like, the last 15 minutes crying to you on the phone. It was very meaningful, I think. So
Yeah, and I do like how she kept certain people really private. We don't really know Joey, her brother, at all.
At all, no. Yeah.
And that's another thing that I really liked about this, because I think maybe sometimes memoirists do reveal the inner lives of people close to them more than what I would want, and more than maybe, like, what they might be comfortable with. I mean, who knows? I don't know. I don't talk to their friends and family, but...
Yeah, and maybe more than they could possibly know.
Right.
You know?
Yes.
Yeah.
This keeps it it's a very tight story, just really about Trethewey and her mother, and then obviously Joel, but, you know, how can you really get to know him?
She does still manage to, like, explain that her mother was, like, not a perfect angel saint, which I think is a compulsion that a lot of people have when speaking about loved ones who have passed away, especially mothers. You know, she makes her mom out to be a good, loving mother, but at the same time, she also shows sometimes when her mom treats her a little coldly, which I think complicates her and makes her a real parent, you know, who sometimes gets, like, annoyed and fed up with her daughter or her young daughter, especially as a single parent. And that, I think, added a lot of dimension to it, because it didn't seem like some kind of angelic memory. It made it seem like she definitely had a grasp on her mom as a complex figure with her own life.
Yeah, I think sometimes people tend to write about people, and it's like the work interview thing where they ask you, like, what's your biggest flaw? And then you say, I work too hard. And it's like, yes, that's not even a flaw at all. And Trethewey didn't fall into that trap. I think we do see how her mother does make mistakes, maybe, and doesn't always make the right decisions. And then how trapped her mother is by, you know, it's the 60s and 70s, and what else do you do but you have to get married?
One thing, maybe, I don't know if we want to end here necessarily, but one memory that she writes about, because again, short book, doesn't write about all that many like specific moments, but when it's just her and her mother living in Atlanta, there's this part where Natasha talks about how she's scared of this closet or like little cubby thing that they have underneath the stairs in their apartment. It's too dark and it's scary. And so her mom comes up with this plan. We're not going to make it brighter so that you're not scared. We're just going to make the dark like more inviting. And so they put up like black fabric on the ceiling part under the stairs, and they put up like kind of like a blackout curtain. And then they cut out stars and put them like on the ceiling part. And it's a, like a little space where she can go and pretend that she's sitting under the stars. And again, it's under the stairs, and they make like a little placard that says like Natasha's place under the stars, which is a very cute pun because it's also under the stairs. And I thought it was just like the sweetest, most creative thing that like these two people like making their lives together on their own can come up with like a solution like that. It was just very beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah. In general, just the way her and her mother's relationship sort of like ebbed and flowed and changed over the years was really good, because you don't always get along with people.
Yeah.
And I think she showed that really well, which of course made it all the more heartbreaking.
Yes. Yeah. You know, if you've read Memorial Drive, let us know if you're interested in checking it out based on this. I think it's a very difficult book, clearly, but I think it's also really worthwhile. It's a very beautiful book and difficult, but kind of necessary at the same time.
Yes, I agree.
Well, thank you for listening to The Bookstore, and hopefully I will have cut out like all of the gross nose snuffles by the time you reach this point.
If you would like to support the podcast beyond listening, you can check out our Patreon at patreon.com/thebookstore or rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. And a big thank you to all of our patrons and everybody who has ever reviewed us on Apple Podcasts.
Yes. Thank you. You can find all the ways you can contact us. We have our email, social media, and our phone line listed at thebookstorepodcast.com.
Our next book discussion will be The Only Good Indians by Stephen Graham Jones. You can find it at your local bookstore or library and read along with us.
The Bookstore is a production of Awkwardly Social Media, produced by Becky Young and Corinne Keener. Technical and production support is provided by Josh Bourdon and Zach Titus.
And John, if you're out there, thanks for listening.
See you next Tuesday.
Bye.
Bye.
Happy October.
Remember Motorola Razors?